I love to sing. Been singing all my life. And I learned to sing in this room when I was a little kid in the little children's choir right here. It's where I began learning how to sing with a group. And so for church throughout the years, children's choir, youth choir, then in school, in choruses, and in high school as well, until I was invited in my junior year of high school to sing in a barbershop quartet. Now, I don't even want to ask how many of you don't know what that is. So Google it. But barbershop quartet singing was, and I believe continues to be for some of us, a really special way of singing. You see, in the barbershop quartet, there's four people, you got that, and no accompaniment, all a cappella. So imagine, as a 16-year-old high school student at the annual choral concert, when it was our turn, after much preparation, three other young men and myself, and I was the second tenor, and there was a tenor, a bass, and a baritone, stepped onto the stage, looked out at probably 500 people for the annual choral concert, and we sang. No piano, just a starting note, and we sang. And that's where I learned the power of partnership. Because I had to do my part. I couldn't randomly forget a note. I couldn't get nervous and stop singing, because all four parts had to work together. The power of partnership came to me in its earliest form as I learned in that setting I had to do my part, or else. Life's about partnerships. A good marriage is a partnership. A good football team is a partnership. Maybe some of you play tennis, doubles tennis. You got to have a good partner. Think about all the dimensions of your lives, whether at work or at school. Life is about partnership, about people coming together, working towards a common goal. Today, we continue our sermon series on the power of partnership, with last week's message having been focused on how we are better together, the big concept. And today, we focus on one of the incredible results of being in partnership spiritually, the result of holy multiplication. The essence for today of this truth, repeated elsewhere in the scriptures over and over, comes from Paul. You remember that Paul was the first missionary, evangelist, teacher in the Christian church. He was converted by Christ in a very supernatural way, and from then on went about teaching and preaching and telling the good news. The rest of his life was spent going around starting churches, house churches, teaching about this risen Christ. In spite of persecution, in spite of being thrown in jail, being tortured, he kept up. And after he would visit a church, start a church, a little group of people in a house, that was the church, he'd then write letters back to them. And that makes up most of our New Testament. And so Paul, in the passage we heard a moment ago, is writing back to a church he has visited about 10 years before. The year of this writing, his letter to the Philippians, is about 63 AD, which is about 30 years after the resurrection, give or take. So not that long. He's visited the church in Philippi 10 years earlier, just 20 years after the resurrection. He's gone there to teach them about Jesus, to teach them what it means to believe in and to follow the risen Christ, for he has experienced him. And so what we find in the beginning, which is the first chapter we look at this morning, what we find is a unique relationship that Paul has with the Philippian church. He says this to them at the start. He says, "I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now." from the first day until now. Scholars have taken a look at all of Paul's letters, of course, and I've studied them as well. And in rereading and learning, we understand that this letter to the church in Philippi is unlike all the other letters. It has got a quality of depth and affection and joy. One of every six phrases seems to be a reflection of his joy. He really loved these people. They really loved him. And this sentence says, from the first day. So it feels like when Paul went to visit them at the very start, they embraced him, they believed, they affirmed him, they supported him. And then he left and went on his way and writes back now, these years later, to say to them, I have such great joy because of your partnership from the first day. From the first day. Now, it's interesting to note that the very first words of this section and this letter is not just from Paul. It's from Paul and Timothy. Timothy was Paul's young protege. We can rather imagine that Paul's in his 50s or a little later, and Timothy's in his 20s. And so Paul, from the very start of his work, has drawn in a young Christian believer to partner with him in going around. So Paul bears witness to the power of partnership in this spiritual journey with Timothy. And then he says, and your partnership, Philippians, has meant so much to me from day one until now. The power of partnership. And of course, the entire history of the early church is about people believing in Jesus, coming together and starting to do the work. It started with the 12 disciples. The first small group, I like to think of them. The first partnership. And then Jesus says, just before he leaves the earth and goes to heaven, he says, go, make more disciples. And so they go out. And soon enough, more and more people. In fact, the book of Acts, written by Luke, the author of the Gospel of Luke, Luke in the book of Acts says that just 7 weeks after the resurrection, about 3,000 people had believed and been saved and added to their number. And later, Luke writes, day by day, the Lord added to our number. The power of multiplication, because people are talking about their faith. And as they do this, people are coming to follow. And then we find that others in the church begin to come along. The early church, for the first 300 years, was an illegal sect. It was a crime to be a Christian. It was an underground church. But it kept growing. It kept multiplying because of the power of the truth of Christ. Then, in the year 315, give or take, the emperor of Rome decides, I can't beat them because they keep growing, so I'll join them. Constantine, by decree, made the entire Roman Empire Christian. It was no longer illegal. The multiplication of the church just boomed because of the truth of Christ. And then that began a great time of church building, because now it was legal to do so. So people started building great edifices where God's glory could be reflected and people could come to worship. And over some 1,000 years came this great boom of construction. Buildings whose very presence influenced people to faith, as people would see the beauty and the glory and the grandeur and all the icons and all the paintings and other things in those great cathedrals. You've visited some of them. They've been there for maybe 1,000 or more years. And the influence of those places on people has been great. And all because people came together in a partnership called the church and then began to multiply. That's how the church has come to be. Some of the names in recent history in the Reformation era, since 1500 or so, are more known to us than others. So it was Martin Luther who first started the Reformation, beginning the Lutheran Church. How did he do that? He came together with a few other people who disagreed with what was going on at the time in the Roman Catholic Church. It was that partnership of dissent that led to this reform movement. First Lutheranism, and then John Calvin partnered with Martin Luther. And then eventually he came to develop the theology that became the Presbyterian Church and Calvinism. And then from there, eventually William Tyndale, the first translator of the English Bible, a corollary to and a contemporary of Martin Luther. They partnered together, and then he felt the call to translate the Bible at the cost, by the way, of his own life. And the influence that that English translated Bible had was immense. Fast forward a little bit more to our own heritage, John Wesley in the 1700s. John Wesley, an Anglican priest, who sees in his own church, of the Episcopal Anglican Church in England, things that he doesn't quite agree with, so he wants to do things differently. What's the first thing he does? He brings together a group of other like-minded young Anglican priests. They're all in their 20s. They all are saying, you know, the English church, the Anglican church, isn't really doing what they're supposed to do. We think it should be focused on this, the poor, going out into the community, going out in the world, serving people in need more than it was being done. So they came together in a partnership. When they came together in that partnership, it was intense. They called it the Holy Club. They would meet from about 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. every day for Bible study, for singing hymns, for praying, for discerning God's will. They were disciplined prayer warriors, disciplined scripture readers. Every morning, over and over, this Holy Club, this partnership of people who saw God perhaps doing something different. In fact, as an aside, maybe you know this, after a while, some of the other young people around, young leaders in the church, saw what John Wesley and his friends were doing and said, "You're nuts." I don't know if they said it that way, but that's what they meant. "What are you doing? Getting up all this discipline and reading and 4 a.m. And at one point somebody said, "You're just a bunch of Methodists because of all this method." That's where the word comes from. We are Methodists because of John Wesley's method with other people. The partnership that they had, the Holy Club, led to the influence that transformed England in the Great Awakening, came to America in the expansion of this country in the 1700s. The rest is history. It starts with partnership. The influence is multiplied as people come together and then go out. Or I think of another. Francis. Francis was a young man who heard God's voice in the 12th century, God saying, "Go repair the churches. Repair the churches that had fallen into disrepair, that had been destroyed." He heard that voice. He had a great future as a son of a wealthy merchant. His career path and his financial security were guaranteed. He walked away from it and walked away from his family and said, "God called me to do this." What was the first thing then Francis did? He went to the Pope and said, "I want to start an order, a group of us to do this." And the Pope at the time agreed, and thus the Franciscan order of monks was established, still this day, a group doing wonderful work in the world for Christ. It was in that community of the Franciscan order that one day Francis wrote a prayer. It was the impact and the influence and the power of being in that order that enabled him, by the inspiration of God, to write that wonderful prayer, "Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love." You know the rest. That prayer has had more influence on more people than 90% of everything that's ever been written about Christ. And it came out of the community, the Franciscan order, that he was a part of. And the influence grew from there. That's how God works, bringing us together in the church, inviting us to partner together, and then sending us out to be influencers, to multiply this influence by how we speak and how we live. It's a holy multiplication. Think of it another way. If you have children, I have some news that may discourage you. Your great-great-grandchildren will not have your picture on their refrigerator. They might not even know your name. Think about it. Because that's how life is. Do you know the names of your great-great-grandparents? Many people do not. My point being that with time, everything fades. Have you received some awards? Have you been recognized? Have you received accomplishments, made accomplishments and done things that the world says, oh, that's great. Guess what? That's all gone in a few years. Nobody's going to remember. What is the legacy then? What's the legacy that we can leave on this earth? One has written well that the primary thing that we can leave, our primary legacy, is our influence on other people. That lives on invisibly in their lives, in other movements, as we've illustrated already, and in other ways. Your influence is what lives on. Oh, maybe not your name as the influencer, the way we might think of a St. Francis. That doesn't matter. You can influence future generations by how you live and how you are a Christian. You see, God has entrusted to the church the task of carrying on and passing forward the spiritual influence of Jesus Christ, the ethics, the morals, the teachings. That's how you can have a lasting impact. The multiplication of your influence through the church and your participation in the partnership of the church goes on and on and on. Even as I know, I have been influenced by unknown people and known from hundreds of years ago as it is echoed down and I've heard or read. How does it work? This power of partnership in the church. It works by inviting people to join the partnership. And then by going forth to influence others in the work. In human relations terms, it's called synergy. Synergy, by definition, is the net total result of all the energy of a group of people plus more. Synergy means if there's 10 people in a room with X amount of energy, those 10X is added to because they're together. That's called synergy. Or maybe another way to look at it is this way. Let's take a look at this video. Okay, they're silly little cartoons, but they convey truth. They convey the truth that when people partner together in common mind, in common will, and common purpose, the total influence is far greater than what one could do alone. I mentioned my early singing. There was another time with a choir director in this church who was very, very demanding of her choral groups. Music's always been so wonderful here, and we've had great choral directors and still do. In my high school church choir at the time, the director was wanting such perfection out of what we sang that if there were 20 of us there in the choir and one or two weren't quite on key, she would say to them, in front of us all, You and you mouth the words. Mouth the words. It seemed, I mean, it wasn't me, so okay. But now in retrospect, it's ouch. Your contribution isn't needed, even if it's not on key. Friends, now in this church, everyone's voice is needed. Everyone's voice is welcome. Your voice is welcome. Your voice is needed in our partnership. And that's really what this Stewardship Month is all about as we work towards our decisions about next year. You've been hearing about it. You're going to hear a wonderful testimony in just a moment about it. When we invite you to be a part of stewardship, making a commitment of time, talent, and treasure in 2 weeks at this altar and other worship service altars, we're basically saying to you, your voice matters, your gift matters, your talent matters, your dollar matters, your $1 million matters. It doesn't matter. It all does come together in the power of partnership. And then the influence of what we can do together is so much more than what we could do ever by ourselves. You're a part of the Church of Jesus Christ, which from the beginning has brought people together and then sent them out to influence the world. It's a great and a glorious calling. And I invite you more and more to say, yes, I want to be a part of this partnership called the church. Amen.